Hello. You have discovered the Felon File. FelonFile.com is a podcast exploration and discussion of law enforcement, history, issues, and incidents in the Appalachian Mountains and elsewhere. Felon File is hosted by Scott Lunsford, retired police detective, sergeant, author and researcher. The Shade of Blue stories for Felon File today. Western North Carolina, 1897. A young lady in her early 20s walked home from church. The young woman went slowly, as she had been crippled by meningitis when she was younger. She lived nearby with her parents near the town of Weaverville. At 11:30 that day, she was attacked. Shoved to the roadway by a large man. He dragged her into the roadside woods and assaulted her. A crowd formed, looking for a suspect. Finding one, the mob acted. Was it justice? Or another crime? Scott has some answers. Background music. Hard Boiled, hosted by Purple Planet. The sponsor for today's episode of The Felon File is The Salty Heifer Home Store and More. For consignments, Lairways, Antiques and Home Decor. Located at 75 Roy Edwards Lane, Mars Hill, North Carolina. Contact Trish, the owner, at thesaltyheifer75@gmail.com. Scott, we're recording.
Welcome once more to another episode of Felon File, where, as Victoria said, we look at law enforcement, court cases, crimes and punishment, the good guys, the bad guys, the not-so-smart guys, the crazy guys, the crazy gals, and anything that would make a good story, what we refer to as a shade of blue story. Blue, of course, referring to law enforcement as opposed to the other type of shade of blue story. Our shade of blue story for today is a story that occurred in 1897, Buncombe County, to be exact. A young lady by the name of Katie Henderson, 23, 24 years old. I've seen newspaper articles listing her at 22, and I've seen other documents that list her at 26, and I haven't been able to find a death certificate or birth certificate to prove either way. So we're going to split the difference, say 24-year-old young lady lived in Weaverville, North Carolina, just outside the city of Asheville, in between the city of Asheville and Madison County. One day, Sunday, as a matter of fact, around 11:30, Miss Katie Henderson was walking home by herself from church when she was accosted and attacked by a man. The man knocked her down, drug her into the roadside wooded area. Miss Katie begged to be let go, screaming for help. The assailant pulled out a handgun and threatened to kill her if she didn't be quiet. One aspect of Katie Henderson was that she was slightly handicapped due to an illness that she had several years previously when she was much younger. This made it very difficult for her to fight back. The man choked her until she almost passed out. Then he sexually assaulted her. After he raped her, he ran off, leaving her lying there in the woods. Katie, hurt and scared and confused, the young lady was able to make it to a house that was close by, the house of James S. Coleman, and he made notification to law enforcement and the authorities of what had happened. As word spread of the incident, a mob of men formed together and went out to search for the rapist, who had about a 40-minute head start by the time they started looking. Katie was taken by the Colemans. After being taken home, Katie was examined by two doctors who went out to the house after hearing of the incident, Dr. James Gill of Weaverville and Dr. D.E. Seaver of Asheville, who happened to be in the area at the time. Katie was able to provide a physical description of the African-American male who had assaulted her, describing to the doctor, Dr. Seaver, as a black male, heavily built, and about 23 or 24 years old. She told the doctors that she would know him if she saw him again. She was absolutely positive about this. Now, the search continued for a suspect for several days. The so-called posse included several individuals, Reimer, Ramsey, Smith, Michael Aiken, and Charlie Reimer, to name just a few. 2 days after the assault occurred, around 4 o'clock in the morning, 48 hours after the assault, a group of men came across an individual walking down Whitemore Branch carrying a lantern. The man ended up being a local preacher by the name of Sandy Ray, and he was on his way to his regular job. Ray told them that the night before, a young black man had shown up at his door in Barnardsville asking for shelter, stating that the man may still be there because when he left his cabin, the young man was still inside asleep. Now, with this information, several of the individuals and men proceeded to the preacher's cabin. That's where they did find the young black male sleeping in the bed. He told the group that his name was Bob Brackett, a 23-year-old laborer from Coswell County. He'd come to Buncombe County to do some work about a year and a half earlier and just had been moving on from one work job to the next. Well, this being the only young black male that they were able to find, the proper age, and matching somewhat the description of what the victim had given, they secured Brackett, and he was taken from the preacher's house very quickly. He didn't even have a chance to put a pair of shoes on. Deputy Joe Chambers, who had been with the men, led the prisoner to a location to meet with other deputies to take the 23-year-old man to Asheville and to jail. Well, that didn't sit well with the group of people that were slowly growing. More people started joining this posse, so to speak. Their plan was to go ahead and just hang Brackett right then and there. Now, the closer they got to the city of Asheville, the angrier the crowd became, and the bigger the crowd got as well. If they had not met the group of other deputies who had been sent out to intercept them, the crowd probably would have gotten their way. The deputies tried to keep the peace and deliver their prisoner as they initially intended. Parts of the crowd attempted to make a deal with the deputies, offering them, well, let's just give him 100 lashes on the bare back and then he can be taken to Asheville for trial. Well, the deputy said no to this suggestion. Now, but as the writer Harry Harrison said, take the IQ of the smartest man in a group and divide that number by the number of people in the group, and you will be given the functioning IQ of the crowd itself. As the mob called for a vote to decide what to do, and they planned on overruling law enforcement and the law, or let it go. So they took a vote. Very big of them, don't you think? Now, as they traveled, the group continued again, getting larger and larger. Some tried to calm down their neighbors and their thirst for revenge and blood. And by the time they reached Weaverville, the mob had swelled to almost 300 men and boys, with most of the crowd being armed, according to newspaper reports. The posse, or should I say mob at this time, did agree to hand over Brackett to the deputies, but their contention was they were going to take him to the victim's house for identification first. Now, about this time, a deputy Reynolds rode up. Reynolds had been sent specifically by Sheriff Worley and Buncombe County Commissioner Brown with this message. If the men were certain they had the right man, a special term of court would be called at once. Now, the mob, heavily armed and not really thinking right because there were so many of them, they had already surrounded the home of the victim by this point, and they were demanding that she identify the suspect that they had caught and make sure that they had the right guy so they could have their immediate justice. They planned on hanging him right there. Dr. Gill, the Weaverville doctor who had arrived early to treat Katie's injuries and to follow up on how she was doing, told Deputy Reynolds to inform the loud yelling crowd that they had to stay back away from the house. They were upsetting his patient. Brackett would be brought inside the home to see if he could be identified as the rapist by the victim. But the crowd had to get back. Now, Brackett did go inside to be identified. And Katie, it goes without saying, was not any type of mental stability to identify her assailant. But Dr. Gill was concerned that the outside mob of angry, yelling men would not help his patient in the least. One problem was that as soon as Deputy Reynolds ordered the men to back out and move away from the house and leave the area, they just basically ignored him. The Henderson family yard stayed filled with the loud, angry men, some wishing to see Katie confront her attacker in front of them. Brackett was taken into the house. The rope on Brackett's wrists were removed so that he could take off the checkered shirt he was wearing at that time and put on a plain one that they provided for him. That was similar to the description that Katie had given of the man during the assault. Dr. Gill again gave orders that only a few men would be allowed to stand nearby while Katie was brought in to identify Brackett. A deputy McDonald attempted to make this happen, but law enforcement at the scene was incredibly heavily outnumbered. A Godson Ramsey and Charlie Reimer led Brackett into the other room of the house, holding the rope by which they had led and kept him secured with from Preacher Ray's cabin. The doctor brought Katie into the room and placed her in a chair while her mother sat close by at hand. Brackett stood in front of the fireplace, light coming in from a side window illuminating the room, and the suspect. As Katie looked at the man from her chair, it's reported that she cried out, "Oh, what made you treat me so last Sunday? When I told you I was crippled and helpless, why did you choke me as I prayed to God to defend me, and you threatened to kill me if I was not quiet? I would know you among a thousand, and I do swear that you are the man." Dr. Gill then turned to Brackett and asked Brackett directly, "Did you ever see this lady before?" Brackett responded with, "Never saw her before." And Katie shouted back out, "Yes, you did. I knew you the minute my eyes flashed on you." Now, Reynolds told Brackett to put on his hat. When he did, Katie said again that he was the man who had assaulted her. Again, the deputy asked Brackett if he had been the man who had attacked her. And he replied, "I don't think I ever saw her. No, sir, I never saw her before." Of course, word of the positive identification made its way quickly outside to the loud, waiting crowd, or mob as it may be. The men grew angrier and more vocal, shouting to bring Beckett out. Deputy McDonald, seeing the emotions and anger of the crowd, stood in front of Brackett as the two of them emerged from the house, kind of protecting him. McDonald told the crowd he had a warrant for Brackett's arrest and intended to take him to the jail at Asheville to await trial. "I will pledge myself," McDonald yelled, straining to be heard over the noise of the crowd. "The commissioners will call court next week for his trial." Well, for one thing, there's no way he could have actually had a warrant for Brackett's arrest so quickly, unless there had been a justice of the peace in the crowd or on hand. And realistically, that's not out of the realm of possibility, so maybe he did have a warrant. Situations like this are why single-person lineups are never done in modern times. There is an option that is allowed called a show-up identification, where a suspect, singular, is brought before a victim for identification. The courts have ruled that this must be done in just a matter of minutes after the commission of the crime. You walk up, the crime's being committed, the guy runs off, you go and get him, chase him down, you bring him back to the victim and present him and say, "Is this the guy that did it?" And the victim says yay or nay. Now, like here, we had over 48 hours passing since the crime had been committed when the show-up or identification was made. Would not hold up in court today. As Brackett stood there with Deputy Reynolds and Deputy McDonald, one man yelled out, "God knows he ought to be lynched." The crowd took up that yelling, that lynch him, bring him out, tear his head off. Now, in the middle of all this yelling and shouting for lynching, Katie came out of the house and onto the porch and spoke to the crowd. She said, it's documented that she said, "I prayed in my helplessness that God would spare my life and send friends to avenge me, and now they have come to help me." Well, as you can guess, this didn't help matters any at all. The inflamed crowd got even more so. As they set out towards Asheville, Deputy Reynolds made sure Brackett was mounted on a horse directly behind his horse and basically surrounded with other deputies and other men he could trust. Reynolds still, the whole time, attempting to keep the rowdy crowd or this mob of people yelling, hang him, tried to reasoning with them. But they drowned out most of what he said for the most part. He told them, if you hang him, you are all known. You will all be tried for murder. And the crowd shouted back, well, that's okay with us. We'll take care of that when that happens. Now, there was a gentleman in the crowd by the name of Walter Vandriver of Weaverville. He rose up in his stirrups from his horse and spoke to the mob and tried to get them to calm down. He told them that a lynching would sully the fair name of the county and their city of Weaverville, or their town of Weaverville. It would be a terrible crime, he said. He begged them to restrain themselves. A few other men who had been trying to calm the crowd could now be heard, now that things kind of got a little bit quiet, and the mob reluctantly dispersed. Brackett and the others stayed on horseback and continued their trek towards the jail at Asheville. Now, as they rode, one of the county commissioners, Commissioner Brown, by that time had joined up with the deputies. And as they rode into town, Brackett actually confessed to Commissioner Brown that he had, yes, in fact, assaulted Katie. He said he had been in Asheville for a week and was returning to the Big Ivy community when he saw Katie walking on the road and was suddenly overcome with desire, for lack of a better term. He admitted that she cried out for him to stop, and he admitted to paying no attention to her cries, but said he was sorry that he didn't stop when she begged him to. The posse had arrived soon in Asheville around 3:15. With the deputies and about 50 horsemen protecting Brackett, according to what the newspaper said, hundreds who heard about the rape and the posse gathered soon outside the jail. Once Brackett was placed inside, Commissioner Brown telegraphed Judge Everett asking for a special court session to be called immediately, the very next morning. While the crowd surrounding the jail, eventually they left off, but there was no peace in the cells that night at the jail in Asheville. By order of the sheriff, Deputy Sheriff McDonald removed Brackett from his cell and left to take him to a safer place as soon as the crowd dispersed. Meanwhile, several individuals who were hanging out around the jail at the time found out about this or heard about it. They passed the word along to others that Brackett was going to be moved. Now, this caused a new mob to be formed. They met up in a vacant lot in town, not too far away from the jail, near some warehouses. And there they voiced their opinions on the matter. The paper reported 200 angry men attended this meeting, for lack of better terms. We'll call it a lynching rally. The majority of the crowd determined that the intel on the defendant being moved was merely a red herring to confuse the would-be lynchers. They figured that he was still there in jail. Now, another crowd formed at the town square. a location we call Pack Square today, where the Vance Monument used to stand until it was taken down, preacher Reverend J.T. Betts was at that location, attempting to keep the peace and to get cooler heads to prevail and keep things from getting out of control. By around 8 in the evening, the crowd began to move, and as they walked to the jail, more joined in with the crowd, which would be expected. They were stopped by a gate to the jail yard, where the chief of police had been stationed. But he didn't see the extent of the danger, so he really didn't do much about it. He just told them they couldn't come in. Sheriff Worley, inside the jail, heard all the yelling and the demanding of the prisoner be released, and he came out and tried to deputize several of the men in the crowd to be used to help him protect his jail. They didn't like that idea. He couldn't get anybody to be willing to take his side or work for him temporarily. Worley realized that no one would stand with him against this mob, except the chief of police that he had there with him now. The sheriff backed against the jailhouse door to prevent anyone from getting through, and he stood his ground. Now, the keys to the jail were demanded, but again, the sheriff refused, telling everyone he didn't have them. The keys were inside. Now, Sheriff Worley tried to convince again the crowd that the prisoner had been moved, and he wasn't there. The sheriff offered two or three of the men to come inside and see for themselves. But when these two or three men approached, they attacked the sheriff and the chief, and they were both overpowered and shoved to the side. Now, using a heavy piece of wooden timber, the jail door was smashed down with its battering ram. City attorney and future North Carolina governor Locke Cragg and Solicitor McCall were inside the jail, and they also attempted to stop the riot, which it had become now, but they were drowned out and pushed aside. Using hammers and crowbars, they locked jail cells were opened. After a search of the building, they found that Brackett wasn't there. Now, six white prisoners were let loose, but none of the black prisoners were released. Disappointed and infuriated at not finding Brackett, they took out their rage on the jail itself, smashing up the place, demolishing it as much as they possibly can. Deputy McDonald and another officer were in a carriage with Brackett heading over Beaumont Gap, going to Swannanoa to catch an early train to Raleigh. Now, this was around 1:40 a.m. Brackett and the deputies were at the train station in the community of Terrell, about 12 miles outside of Asheville. Just as they were starting to board the number 16 train to head to Raleigh, a new crowd showed up. They had tracked the officers and the defendant down. This new crowd was yelling for both the deputies and Brackett to be hung. Now, taking their prisoner from them, the officers were able to fight their way through the crowd and to get away and not be hung. Running to the telegraph office, Deputy McDonald tried to send a message back to Asheville with what was going on, information, and ask for help, but the operator refused to do so. Now, having the prisoner in their custody, the mob could not decide where they were going to kill him. Where should we hang this guy? They finally decided on taking him back to the scene of the crime. The county militia had been called up by that time to help prevent the lynching and intercept the mob on their way back. North Carolina Governor Russell, who had been informed what was happening, and that the mob had ended up overwhelming the officers on their way to Raleigh, he called out for the Asheville Light Infantry to assist Sheriff Worley in preserving law and order. Tuesday morning on August 10th, a company of men, 43 in number, and Sheriff Worley left the Asheville Armory and headed to Weaverville. The governor sent a telegraph to Colonel Lusk, Colonel Virgil Lusk, stating that if Brackett was not lynched, but convicted by a jury, Governor would personally guarantee he would be hung within 2 weeks. Tuesday morning, August 10th, a company of 43 men and the sheriff and some of the sheriff's men left the armory here in Asheville and headed to Weaverville. The governor sent a telegram to Colonel Virgil Lusk stating that if Brackett was not lynched, but would be convicted by a jury, or was convicted by a jury, the governor would personally guarantee to the community that the defendant would be hung within 2 weeks. Now, this information was passed on to the mob, or the mass of men who now held Brackett in custody, and they didn't care for it. Brackett was taken 4 miles northeast of Weaverville to Hemp Hill Schoolhouse. One newspaper described the atmosphere as an enthusiastic assembly, not unlike an old Methodist camp meeting. That is a heck of a way to describe a lynching party. Katie was there to hear Brackett's last words, and he admitted to being the man who had assaulted her. He made no protest, and a rope was placed around his neck, and Brackett was lifted up by the rope, and the rope was fastened to a limb and tied off. Then Brackett was dropped, breaking his neck, and he died quickly. Ghoulish souvenir hunters now took reign. Looking for anything connected with the hanging, they cut pieces from Brackett's clothing, pulled cords from and cut sections from the hanging rope. Now, when I was in the 7th grade, I was visiting a friend of mine whose family lived in Weaverville. I was shown a 2-inch section of a brown worn cord or rope. Now, the other young man who was showing to me, my friend, said it came from what I believe was the Brackett hanging. My friend told me it came from a hanging of a man for rape in Weaverville a long time ago, and this particular relic had been in his family for years. In researching this podcast, I contacted my friend and asked him about that old piece of rope. He told me that it wasn't long after he'd shown it to me that his mother had ordered his father to destroy the relic, and he told me his father had burned it in the driveway. But that's not the last of the relics or the souvenirs that were taken. Women took branches and cut bits of bark off the large oak limb that had held the hanging rope. Some women even wore twigs from the hanging tree as relics, as jewelry, pinning them to their dresses. Sheriff Worley and the state troops arrived at the Henderson home there in Weaverville, but never caught up with the lynchers. Instead, they were confronted by about 200 armed men who claimed to have no knowledge of where the lynching party had taken Brackett. The militiamen mounted back up to go and search. This triggered the crowd, and they surrounded the militia and refused to let them leave. The militiamen countered this by forming battle lines and lines of fire. Eventually, the men blocking the roadways gave way. But feeling they had accomplished their purpose in delaying the militia, they jeered and hissed and yelled and screamed and poked fun at the militia and the sheriff. By the time the troops reached the Hemp Hill Schoolhouse, the body of Bob Brackett was hung lifelessly in a tree. By that time, most of the onlookers or the people involved had left. A captain with the North Carolina State Troops sent the governor a telegram. I arrived on the scene 14 miles from the city at 2:50 and found the man hanging to a tree, dead. All is quiet and the sheriff has dismissed the company. Now, after the hanging, Sheriff Worley called for an inquest with a jury of about 6 men. A number of witnesses were examined, but none could or would give testimony about who had actually had a hand on in the hanging of Brackett. It was announced that whoever had released the federal prisoners in Asheville, though, would be charged. The body of Brackett was taken to Jesse Starnes' mortuary in Asheville, where it was held for the coroner. Coroner Reed held an inquest with about 6 men, summoning the jury of 6 men to hold his own inquest. The coroner figured there were 2 questions. Who had hung Bob Brackett, and who had freed the prisoners from the Asheville jail? I don't see what the coroner's inquiry would have with the jailbreak or the jail freeing of the prisoners. Those are the 2 issues that they looked at in that coroner's hearing. Reed took testimony from several witnesses, to include a W.E. Breeze, Jr., who testified that Sheriff Worley had summoned him to go with a posse to Rims Creek, where Brackett was found to be hung. Chief of Police James, who along with Worley had been shoved aside by the mob storming the jail, testified at the inquest that they had recognized a few individuals, one being a Milt Ledford and a W.T. Hermitage. Hermitage did speak about the hanging party. He claimed 15 men who had been also part of the group of men at the train station that had brought Brackett back to the hanging site. They had bound his feet and hands and hung up the rope there. Sheriff Worley testified kind of in his own defense against the fierce criticism for having protected the prisoner in the jail, but he'd been directed to do so by the solicitor and other county officials. 4 days after the initial rape had occurred, the coroner inquest was completed. Although the governor wanted to issue warrants for those responsible, no one was willing to identify them in court. Eventually, a grand jury in Hendersonville, in the adjoining county of Henderson, they found 3 separate indictments on individuals involved with the break-in and the assaults at the jail. One was for a Dilbert Del Ross for breaking into the jail to lynch Bob Brackett. Another was for Will Huntley and George Bryant. And a third was found for J.W. Morris. Now, Ross was charged with murder, according to some documentation, but I was unable to find anything along those lines of a murder charge. I was able to find where he was found in the grand jury and indicted for the jailbreak. Now, Ross was said to be one of the ringleaders in the lynching. Now, 2 years later, after the incident had occurred and the storming of the jail, Deputy Sheriff Reed ended up arresting George Bryant for the breaking into the jail on the night in question. Bryant paid a $100 bond and was released. I could not find any other follow-up on Bob Brackett's court case. Now, if Ross was charged with the murder, there's no mention of it, of the resolution of a trial reported. If Ross was involved, it appears he did get away with it. After 2 years after the lynching, Ross joined the United States Army, served in the Spanish-American War. At one point, he was listed to have died or been killed in action in the Philippines, but that was later found out not to be true when some individuals who had served with Ross came back to Asheville after their time in the military was up, and they told the local newspapers that, to their knowledge, Ross was still in Havana, Cuba, and had never made it to the Philippines, and they had seen him alive and well. Not unusual for a mistake like that to have been made. Now, what came of Ross? Well, he came, like I said, I couldn't find anything further on Ross's being charged with murder. As far as the jailbreak is concerned, there is law in North Carolina that says any criminal jurisdiction in a district where a jailbreak happens has jurisdiction over a jailbreak in order to try somebody for that crime, which explains why Henderson County, the next county over, was trying the jailbreak case. But whether Ross was able to be convicted or not, it's unknown. It shows where he posted a $400 bond, but it's soon after that bond being posted that he joined the military and left the country. He did return to Asheville after serving in the military and became a fireman. And his name shows up periodically in various newspapers of the time, going up to 1920, as being a member of the Asheville Fire Department. On May 30th of 2021, the Buncombe County Remembrance Project, in conjunction with the Equal Justice Initiative, held a series of 3 soil collection ceremonies in a memorial to the victims of lynchings in Buncombe County. Now, there's no question that the man was lynched. The second of the 3 being remembered in that ceremony was Bob Brackett. The Buncombe County Remembrance Project, their aim is to acknowledge and remember individuals that were lynched in Buncombe County, remind us of the importance of following the rules and following the law. Brackett may have been guilty. We'll never know for sure because there was no trial. And a trial by riot just doesn't cut it. Well, that's our Shade of Blue story for you today. Remember to come back next week on Saturday, 7 o'clock, for another episode of Felon File. If you want more information on the podcast or my books, you can check out scottlunsfordauthor.com or go to felonfile.com, where there's a link where you can purchase my books, as well as a link back to the podcast. We have plenty of podcasts on file if you want to listen to some of those. Also, I'd love to hear from you. There's a link on both websites for making comments and letting us know what you think. Right now, we have individuals in 30 countries around the world that are listening to Felon File Podcast. Thank you guys for listening. We appreciate you all. And in the coming weeks, no matter where you're at, try to be safe, be secure, and if you're given the opportunity, do something nice for somebody. It's really the right thing to do. It could actually make a big difference in your part of the world. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to y'all later. Bye, y'all. Victoria, you got it.
You have been listening to the Felon File Podcast with your host, Scott Lunsford. For more information on this podcast or Scott's books and writings, go to scottlunsfordauthor.com and felonfile.com. Scott can also be contacted at these web pages. This is Victoria, your producer. Thank you for listening. 2. 1. End.